Okay, okay. Internet, I'm so I'm getting nothing but feedback here. But I was just trying to get a more of a specific idea of how you set up the equipment to be able to do that. I've heard with some of these kind of tests, it takes special filters that will notch out the carriers to be able to directly look at them, because you obviously can't put that kind of high power into an instrument directly yourself. So you have to take the two carriers and treat and deal with them first of all, to make sure they're not going to overload your instrumentation or damage it. That's kind of like what I was getting at. It's more of a specific test setup of what you're doing. But okay, you pretty much answered what I'm looking for so far.
Yeah, you blithely said the word notch filter to notch out the individual carriers so you don't overload the instrumentation. That rolls off the tongue real easily. How does the notch filter work? It rejects that frequency. Rejects it where? Everything has to obey conservation of energy. That energy that you're rejecting in that notch is going to reflect back to something that's going to make it unhappy. You reflect it back to your amplifier, and I guarantee your amplifier is going to become nonlinear because of all that reflected energy. You put it back through a circulator that wasn't designed for that particular amount of power, and so on. So when I told you about constant impedance filtering, that's just part of the ingredients of what's required. You got to really worry about, of the rejected energy, where is it going and what harm is it doing and how do I stop it from doing that? Most of the dummy loads that I own cannot pass this test, because as the dummy load heats up with that total of 40 watts of power and you watch its passive into modulation distortion crawl all over the place, because the individual thermal elements inside of a dummy load are growing physically because they heat up and they're changing their dimensions, which means the finger stock that holds them down to the heat sink is sliding. And any sliding metallic objects are going to make passive into mods up the kazoo. So how do you find a dummy load that will pass the test in order to even perform the test, in order to calibrate your instrumentation? There's a zillion problems. There's 40 ways you can do it wrong and very few ways you can do it right. It's an extremely severe test. And so of all of the instrumentation that I've ever become acquainted with, this is one of the toughest ones. I've worked on a development program for a greater than 100 decibel dynamic range display spectrum analyzer. I've also worked on vector network analyzers that can do things somewhat like that. But that didn't come close to this particular exposure that I had a couple of years ago while pursuing that particular client's needs. Okay, let's see if Joe number two is still there. KC2. Quebec Yankee Whiskey Mobile K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe. Okay, maybe he got called away. I think I've answered the questions. I think we've gone through the questions of the people who signed in so far. If not, please speak up right now, K2RIW.
Question WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul. Hey, Paul. You know, first of all, a couple of days ago was July 16th, a very famous day 40 years ago, which Walter Cronkite started becoming very famous by announcing the fact that Apollo 16 had just taken off, and these guys are on one of the biggest adventures of mankind to try to go to the moon. Tomorrow is July 20th, the day that Armstrong and Aldrin first put man's feet, call it what you like, on that lunar surface. And to many people, that's one of the biggest things that happened in the 20th century. So some famous days are about to occur. I hear tell that Aldrin, Collins, and Armstrong are going to be guests of the president probably today, tomorrow, the next day, in order to increase the celebration of this 40th anniversary of that very significant event. And it looks like NASA is talking about going back to the moon sometime in the vicinity of the year 2020. Back to you, Paul, with your question and or anything you want to tell us about space. Now's a good time for it. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW.
Okay. Yeah, I had a question, but just comment on the space program first. By the way, right now there's a show. It started at 9 o'clock. It's a one-hour show on National Geographic Channel. That they talk about the future of the space program. So I guess it's supposed to have something to do with going back to the moon supposed to get on at 12 o'clock at night. I'm gonna record it from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock in the morning. Just for anybody that wants to set their recorders for that, if they have cable. You need a lot of advertisers to get the program to get to where I would like to see it, at least, you know, send people back to the moon. Endeavour is doing good right now with the International Space Station. They have a record amount of people in space, 13 people. And they have one bathroom problem. There's three up there, one in the VESDI module, and then there's another one in one of the other modules. I don't know which one I forgot, but then there's a bathroom in the Endeavour, and the Russian module is having problems. So you got quite a crowd up there, and they will be there for a while. The 16-day mission, one of the main things is to install the outdoor porch for all the different tests to the Kaibo Japanese module. Kaibo meaning hope. That's taken three shuttle missions. This is the third to get all the components up there. It's the biggest of all the modules we dropped.
Let me break in for a second here, Paul. I just remembered something that Joe number one told me earlier today. I think it's at 9:44 tonight. There will be a shuttle sighting approximately north or northeast. And it's one of these lit in the sun type things where the shuttle is above the horizon and a brightly lit object against the dark sky. It's a striking thing to see. I hear tell if you go to www.nasa.gov and look up a shuttle sighting, or not shuttle sighting, but in this case, International Space Station sighting, and tell it what address you're at. It'll tell you where to look and when. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, you want to give us a couple more words on that? You got it, Joe.
Yeah, I remember it to be 9:44 p.m. tonight, and it's, I think, an inclination of... I think it's at 16 degrees for the one tonight, but they said it's going to be a viewing time of approximately 3 minutes. It said it would arrive over the horizon around the north, and the departure would be like east, northeast. 3 minute window duration, as high as, I believe, 16 degrees. So if you got someplace you can look north, without too many trees in the way, you should be able to see it. I saw it the other night. I was down here by the water, down where I live. I went down to by the bay. And I was able to see it quite easily, and the funny effect was the one I saw at 10:55. It went about maybe three quarters of the way during over its arc, and then it completely disappeared. And for a moment, I had to think about what was happening, and it was apparently the Earth's shadowing effect made it to completely disappear. But the one at 9:44 should be visible. I've seen these earlier. In the night, I think Tuesday they're going to be around 8:20. No, excuse me, 8:20 or 8:40 or something like that, approximately. There should be another sighting. It should be quite a little closer to just after sunset. And when I have seen these before, just after sunset, and they're very, very visible with the naked eye. You don't need anything special to see them at all. And this thing goes overhead. It's like you're looking at a star going overhead. So they're very, very visible to the naked eye. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so there's going to be a very bright sighting tonight, 9:44 approximately, of the International Space Station, starting at your north and going to your east-northeast. Because it only goes 16 degrees above the horizon, you've got to be in a place that's fairly clear of trees, in the middle of a great big schoolyard, on a beachfront, or whatever. In order for you to judge 16 degrees, know that a fist held out in front of you, at arm's length, from the bottom of your fist to the top of your fist, is very close to 10 degrees. And so the International Space Station will be as high as 16 degrees above your horizon. So that's going to give you a little bit of way of measuring how good is the place you're going to. Are there trees in the way or buildings in the way or whatever? Can you see an object up a little bit lower, hopefully, than 16 degrees above the horizon? If so, go out there and look at 9:44 and enjoy. Back to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I can't remember one, but it's supposed to be naturally a lot easier now that you've got almost a complete space station built. size of a football field, and you know, the with the big solar panels, four sets of solar panels. It's supposed to be pretty good, and of course you add the space shuttle to it too, and that's a lot more stuff up there, so it should be pretty reflective. I think back to October 4th, 1957, people used to go out and see, you know, the same kind of effect at dusk and see the light bouncing off the one lone satellite, the Sputnik. And what was that? It's like a size of a big basketball or something. And now here these things are up there, probably pretty good. Heavens Above, they say, .com, I think it is. You could also put your numbers in your... And you get the latest passes of the various things, including the space shuttle. I want to see the detached or the space station. Let me drop it. Okay, National Geographic. They do pretty good with their little documentaries. They're excellent. They'll probably talk about the Orion mission coming up. I know there's a test in November. Of the rocket that they want to use, the Atlas V. They're coming along, and we'll get an update from that report when I watch that tomorrow. My question was dealing with the set-top boxes. It was an interesting article about the amount of power that TVs use and things like that. LCD TVs. I have one now, and it's a 32-inch one, and I looked up the specs. It's 103 watts just for a TV. Now, my old cathode ray tube was 73 watts or 75 watts, something like that. So the bigger the screen, more wattage. Plasma TVs is supposed to be more than that. I'm going to drop it. Interesting thing I read was that, you know, they go to low power, you know, and shut them off. It doesn't really draw much, you know, maybe half a watt, I think, on mine. But the article said that these desktop boxes, you know, that come out of the cable companies, don't shut down. They go full blast 24/7. And I thought about it. I said, you know, let me put my hand over this thing. You know, the TV was off for a lot of hours. Put my hand over the box. You know, boy, I tell you, a lot of heat coming off of that. I went on the internet. I haven't found out yet how many watts this thing is eating up, but to some degree, I think it's ringing up everybody's electric bill. So I just mentioned that. Just put a switch in there and shut it down. It's a bit inconvenient because if you get up in the morning, you want to turn it on, it takes sometimes 10, 15 minutes or so before this box reboosts something like a little computer. So, sort of bring that up. I searched on the internet, tried to find out how many watts. I can't figure out how many watts this thing is. I didn't call them, but, you know, and then in my paperwork that you get, there's nothing I told you to expect to this box. But it's hot. And then, just for curiosity's sake, I went over to the direct TV converter, the converter boxes that, you know, for the TV. The digital over-the-air broadcast, put my hand over that. I mean, there's no heat coming off of that in the off position. I didn't try the on position yet, but at least that's okay. But, man, you can't believe the cable boxes, how much heat these things are giving off. So my question is, I wonder if anybody knows how many watts this thing is eating up, 100 watts, 200 watts, 50 watts. My hand feels like 100 watts to me, a little bit better. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I see where you're going here. You're becoming quite green, Paul, and you'd like to know where all the power dissipation is taking place in your house, particularly for things that are supposedly turned off and you're not using at that time. And you could thoroughly unplug them in some cases without losing memory. You also got to be careful about what your hand is telling you. When it comes to a small antenna, you want to know where inefficiency is taking place. Thermal imaging camera is the passive way of doing it. A more active way of doing it is to put 1 watt or 10 watts into it for a couple of minutes, turn off the power, and go over and touch everything. A human hand touching a relatively small object can easily detect the difference of 1 watt because of thermal heating. In the case of something the size of a cable television box, the amount of heating you're sensing, depending on how efficient the airflow through is to it. If it's a completely sealed box and is only dissipating its heat by using the outer walls of the box as a heat sink and no air is flowing through it, then the amount of heat you feel might represent 10 watts. 10 watts wouldn't alarm you. 100 watts would. So it's not easy to judge. In the case of the television screen itself, which is, let's say, 38 inches wide, it's more than 3 feet wide and almost 2 feet high. It's dissipating the energy of its display over 6 or 7 or 8 square feet. And therefore, you may not feel the heat because it's such a wide area. And on top of that, the actual lighting device, let me drop. In a modern liquid crystal display, the actual lighting device in many cases is a cold cathode fluorescent light bulb, which runs at a medium efficiency. There are many people predicting the future where much of that illumination is going to become higher efficiency light-emitting diodes. They're now a little bit pricey, but as they come down in price, light-emitting diodes are going to be the source of illumination for our large flat-screen displays, in which case they'll be running cooler and more efficient as time goes on. Now, you would like to know how many watts is dissipating. There's a fairly quick way you can find out, Paul. You can buy a device where you plug it into the wall and you plug your unknown thing into it, and it tells you power dissipation. There's a number of those things on the market. Even if you don't want to buy the thing that's on the market, or don't want to wait for it to be shipped to you, it wouldn't be very difficult for you to set up a box which has got a male plug on one side and a female plug on the other side, whether it be in the box or on a pendant cable is your choice, but inside the box is simply a 1-ohm resistor, 1-ohm power resistor. And you measure the voltage drop across that 1-ohm resistor. That'll tell you current. And most of the devices you're likely to use are going to run not very high in power factor, so therefore the current phase angle is not going to be very important. A clamp-on ammeter can also do it. So if you own a clamp-on ammeter and you can look at one lead of the two leads of the plug simultaneously, or plug in a 1-ohm resistor and measure the voltage drop across it and interpret it into current, you can get a 95% accurate measurement of the real power dissipation by various things in your house with that kind of a device. And that might be kind of a fun thing to build. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, oh, we are reset. Okay, Dick, let's see, was that the tone? There's the phone. Okay. Yeah, I was going to take another cord, zip cord, a male, female plug, and just separate that so I don't ruin the box. These boxes, you don't own these boxes from Cablevision. You got to return them, especially when they quit. They quit a lot, by the way. I've returned quite a few of them so far. And I was going to plug them right into it and then have my own zip cord. This one may be able to separate the two wires, and I was going to click an amp probe around it and then plug it in, and then that would give me my answer. Easy ways to do it without destroying the plug. I can do it for everything, refrigerators, whatever, and find out how many amps you're drawing, and PIE or PEI formula, and figure out the power rating, no big deal. But I went over to Sears. For these amp probes, click around and say, "Wow, let me just check the internet." I never dawned on me what those things cost. So for one thing, I figured, let me just check the internet. That's a cheap way to go. There is nothing on it. I put the model number in for the box. Whatever this is. I forgot what they call it, Atlanta, floor, or whatever, and 42 or something or other, HD box. Put that in, nothing. Put it back to power. You get all kinds of information, but nothing about how much power this thing eats up. So I figured on the last time that somebody probably came across it. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
N2 Alpha Sierra is here. Just for a quick traffic question, I'm sorry to bother you guys.
Go ahead.
Listen, I'm on, I believe it's 95, and my navigator is taking me to the George Washington Bridge, I believe, but it's very trafficy, and it says 16W will take me to the Lincoln Tunnel, right ahead of me. Am I better off getting off and going toward the Lincoln Tunnel to get home?
I wonder if anyone has a question, an answer for Mr. Into Alpha Sierra Sierra. Doesn't look like anybody on frequency has a suggestion for you, sir. There's another way you can go here, Paul. You can plug in a 1-ohm resistor into a cord, measure the voltage drop on the 1-ohm resistor. The actual wiring itself of your male-female plug has some number of milliohms of resistance, which by a couple of means you can find out how many milliohms of resistance it's got. Put exactly 1 ampere through it by some means and measure the voltage drop in millivolts. And 1 millivolt with 1 ampere flowing is 1 milliohm. So you don't even have to put in a 1-ohm resistor, just the normal voltage drop of the wiring itself. And put the leads of your ohmmeter across one of the leads from the input end to the output end would allow you to measure current. And that's going to tell you 95% of what you want to know, because it doesn't correct for power factor. You'd have to know phase angle of that current versus the voltage. But I don't think you're running inductive machinery, which has got a high power factor, if you know what I mean. So you can measure the power drain by a number of means without spending a whole lot of money. The clamp-on ammeter is a slightly Cadillac approach. Every so often at the flea markets, I will see somebody selling a clamp-on ammeter at very inexpensive prices. But, and I think I own one of those. I think I bought it for something like $50. It's a complete volt-ohm milliammeter, a digital voltmeter with clamp-on ammeter function built into it. The price was so good, I just couldn't turn it down. Eventually, you'll own one of those. Now, the International Space Station, because it is getting so large, it's got so many solar cells, and it's got the Endeavour space shuttle connected to it at the same time. It's really a massive object. So when the sun shines at that on just the right way, and it glints on you back to where you're standing on the Earth, my guess is the International Space Station could become as bright as the planet Venus. What do you think, Paul? Have you ever said in any of the things you've read that it can become as bright as Venus when it flashes at you? WS2N, KQLIW?
I've read that it's bright, and I've heard people say that it's that bright, but I haven't seen it yet, so I'm not gonna comment until I see it. Probably, you know. I mean, I've seen the shuttle reflection of the shuttle go up. You know, actually, it wasn't a reflection. The engines were on, and I'm not gonna say it was as bright as Venus when that went up, but probably as bright as maybe Jupiter, a little less than that. So, but Venus is, you know, that's pretty heavy duty, we'll have to say. I thought I'd mention that. You know, I think this thing is 100 watts, 24 hours a day. It's over, you know, that's a couple of kilowatts every day. Somebody's spending 20 some odd cents, maybe, whatever it is, per kilowatt hour. It's 40, maybe 50 cents a day, you know? You start to add up the months and the years, and think about all the older people and the commercials that they had on before the DirecTV went over, trying to sell everybody on getting into cable vision or you know whatever the kind of part is that was Verizon has the Fios. You know, and only people are hooking these boxes up. You know, all right, whatever they're paying, it's quite a bit of money. Bit of money per month, but I mean, of course I can't compare to it. But boy, wait until I get the electric bills, maybe $50-$60 a year more, just to run their cable box. And, you know, a couple of the old timers are going to say, you know, wow, what did I do here? And then one other comment regarding the TVs. Yeah, I've got this 1080 TV. And then probably 19 or whatever, 100 lines vertically, you know, the other direction. You add up all these LEDs, whatever, you know, it comes out to like 3 million little squares. Let me drop it.
3 million,
probably more little teeny tiny squares, you know, pixels. And I figure within each pixel, don't they have to have like three different LEDs to make the different colors? You looked into that, you know, what's involved with these TVs and, for that matter, the laptop computers, the all the LCD, the LED sets. It's kind of unbelievable. The wiring that must be involved. In, I think the, what was it? Red was straight polarity, and green was reverse polarity, and the yellows were AC or something. I don't know if they stuck to all of that, but you brought up all the LED business before, you know, on a larger scale, on a smaller scale. What is going on with these TVs? How could they bring these prices down to, you know, $600, $700, $500 a bit? I'm just, you know, some of them are getting that low. It's amazing, Dick. What, they got robots making this stuff? Back to you, WS2.
Paul recognized, Joe recognized, we're going to get to you in a second. Each one of those individual pixels on that television screen is not a light-emitting diode pole. Right now, there is a compact fluorescent light behind the display device that's lighting up the whole, let's say, 38 inches wide by 20 inches high, whatever it is. It's lighting up that whole area from the back with one single and maybe two compact fluorescent light bulbs that have an exotic shape to them. And then the liquid crystal display in front of that either does or doesn't let that light through. So all those little pixels do have liquid crystal attenuators, photo attenuators that are voltage variable, but there's not individual light-emitting diodes. When they switch over to the light-emitting diode approach for making a more efficient compact, more efficient flat-screen display, there will be a line of light-emitting diodes that substitute for the exact same location as the single compact fluorescent light bulb that's there now. To my knowledge, they're not going to put individual light-emitting diodes on the individual pixels. That would be a little bit too elaborate. You see where we're going here, Paul? Back to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, because I heard the earlier discussion. They're going to go with the OLED. I've read a little bit about that, and that was the plan to eventually have millions of these. I thought millions of these OLEDs, organic LEDs. Wow. Okay, very good. Well, still, even, you know, even with the LCD screens, you know, each pixel has to be somehow individually done. It's really a leap of technology when you think about it. You know, I haven't given it much thought, but, you know, I thought the cathode ray tube was amazing, that, you know, you could shoot this beam and synchronize everything to hit each individual spot. With adjustments of color and this and that. You know, to go from that to this is even more unbelievable. Unbelievable. Back to you there.
I know it's impressive, Paul, but you ain't seen nothing yet. Just waiting to see what's going to happen in the next couple of years. Joe, W2RYY, Joe number one, go ahead.
Thank you, Dick. I believe if you check the bottom of that box or the back of the box, you may find a UL label on the box, and it probably will tell you the power consumption of that converter box you're talking about. I doubt if something really draws 100 watts. That's a lot of power for a converter box. It's probably talking about in the neighborhood of 15, 20 watts. It feels like it's warm to your hand, but if it was 100 watts, I think you would probably be able to keep your hands on it. Back to you, Dick.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Good idea. I'm going to do that. I couldn't find anything. I'm going to check again.
WA2VDH, start off with your name, sir.
Okay, fine. This is Dick. The handle here is John. Handle is John. And I just wanted to make a comment about the converter box power. I just walked over to the other side of the shack and pulled up the old CFT2200, which was used about 6-7 years ago. And the bottom of it says a power of 23 watts. Go ahead, Dick.
Very fine, John. And so we'll eventually find out if Paul is alarmed by 23 watts. And that's sort of in the threshold. If it were 10 watts, you'd ignore it. If it's 100 watts, you'd be highly alarmed. And 23 watts is somewhere in between. And sometimes those labels are telling you worst-case situation when it's first turned on, and it may not be the steady-state running current, so to speak. The real running current might be more like 15 watts. When in doubt, make a measurement, because sometimes those signs are put on there to be conservative. The sign may be true for, that's the time they put on five different models, and only the model with all the horns and whistles draws that much power. I've seen things like that. If it draws less than that, nobody gets mad at them for putting on that label. They're just putting themselves at a slight disadvantage for a very green person deciding to buy or not buy that particular brand name. All slowly getting smarter about all these things. There's a lot more to go, though. I was at a meeting today with some friends, and I said, gee, do you think these RF devices, wireless devices, combined with computers, do you think it's going to catch on? And we came to the conclusion, probably not. It's just a flash in the pan. Obviously, that's a joke. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
And to APG.
APG recognized, but I heard another double in there. Who was the other person?
That was me, K2KEY.
Okay. Mr. APG first. Go right ahead.
To APG, Dave in Massapequa. Just wanted to make a comment on the visibility and the brightness of the International Space Station. On the brightest passes for the last month or two have been -3 magnitude, which is pretty bright. Tonight's pass is not going to be that bright because it's kind of low. But in the next, you know, within the next 7 to 10 days, there's going to be 2 or 3 pretty bright passes in that -3, you know, magnitude range, which is pretty close to what Venus looks like. It's pretty bright, so heavens above, that's the good place to look.
That's good to know. Okay, so I think you're saying the International Space Station can get as bright as -3 stellar magnitude. Each stellar magnitude is roughly 2.5:1 ratio. 2.51, I think it is. Why that crazy number? Somebody way back in antiquity decided that a 100-to-1 brightness ratio represents 5 steps of what the human eye can easily recognize. So if you take the fifth root of 100, you'll end up with 2.51, or conversely, 2.51 raised to the fifth power is 100. So each stellar magnitude is something like 2.51, I think it is. And so the brightest star in the heaven is the star Sirius, which is a stellar magnitude of -1. Negative magnitudes, by the way, are brighter. Positive magnitudes are dimmer. So the International Space Station of -3 is 2 stellar magnitudes brighter than the brightest star, Sirius, which is to the lower left of the Orion Nebula, the Orion constellation, if you want to know where to look in the sky. And I think you'll see that better as we get closer to fall at the normal hours that we do visual viewing of the sky. So that's 2.5 squared. I guess that's 6 1/4 times brighter is the International Space Station than the star Sirius on a clear night. Reasonably bright. Not quite as bright as Venus. I think Venus can be a magnitude or 2 greater than that. We can find that one out pretty soon. None of these things are going to come close to the total brilliance of the moon, of course. But nothing will subtend. Let me drop anywhere near as big as angle as the moon. There keeps happening every single year. A whole bunch of urban legends that get started, and somebody starts it on the internet, gets excited by it, and passes it to all his friends. And the gist of the hoax is that the planet Mars is going to be brighter than the moon. And it's the brightest you're ever going to see for a zillion years. Pure bull. No way. Mars is a planet that on average is 300 million miles from us, whereas the moon is only 250,000 miles. And both objects have approximately about the same amount of light reflectivity, albedo as it's called. And as such, the object that is, 300 million miles versus 250,000 miles, almost a 1,000-to-1 ratio closer is the moon, which is therefore 1,000,000-to-1 greater in brightness capability because it's an inverse square law. So the moon is capable of being 1,000,000 times brighter than the planet Mars under equal lighting conditions. So if you think that Mars is going to suddenly get that close to be that big and that bright, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you again, because I've sold it a couple of times in the past. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call at KQRIW in the TechNet. By the way, I think I was supposed to get back to Mel. I forgot to. K2KEY, K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
You're supposed to. Okay, I think somebody else is also on frequency that we're supposed to pick up. All right, well, I'll just make a quick comment, a couple of comments. As far as the converter box, the Zenith converter box, I just looked at it, Dick. 3.9 watts, that's what it says here on the bottom, consumption of power. And, yeah, I'll tell you something. I made that measurement one time. I have a clamp meter here, one of the old Ampros. Not a digital, but a regular analog one. But it has a number of scales on it. And, I turned off everything, you know, normally in a house, lights that we have on, things like that. But still, this clock plugged in, DVD player plugged in, a VCR, you know, a couple of TV sets, and all of that are basically in standby position. And you'd be amazed how much standby wattage is being consumed. That's where the electric bill, 24 hours a day, where it gets its boost. And as far as the clamp meter is concerned, they make an adapter, very cute little thing, a little adapter that you can then plug in your DVM into, and you don't have to buy the whole meter. You buy just this one little clamp adapter and then use the meter with it, Dick. So if you're interested in seeing and getting aggravated, how much electric is costing you just when nothing is on is amazing.
Yeah, I'm holding on to a device right now made by the Triplett Company, which is the device that clamps around the wire for measuring current, but it's a standalone, and that in turn gets plugged into my digital voltmeter, so or analog voltmeter, whichever I like. So there are various ways of measuring current without buying the hold-on meter, and that's another way to go, or making yourself a box with a 1-ohm resistor. I know I'm going to give one more call for Joe number two to see if he's still in range. He was a mobile station, and then we'll go over to Joe number one. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey, if you're there, Joe. K2RIW. Yeah, it looks like he got out of range. That's too bad we didn't get back to him sooner. Joe number one, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, go right ahead.
Yeah, being stuffed up by that signal.
Yeah, you're supposed to take an internet break at 9 o'clock. What happened?
What happened is I'm a very forgetful guy, and for 40 minutes you didn't remind me. Let's do a real standby, see if anyone out of area wants to sign into this crazy TechNet and contribute to this jazz that's going on here. Give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW and the TechNet standing by. I'm going to let the machine drop for at least 20 seconds or so.
AC2AZ, Bob here.
Okay, it appears there's no one else. Bob, you've got it. AC2 Alpha Zulu, K2RIW. I think your name is Bob.
Yeah, that's it, Dick. Bob. Had a question for the HF guys down here.
Go ahead with your HF question for the guys down there. Where is down there, by the way?
Well, wherever you guys, I'm here on Long Island. I'm trying to put up an antenna, and I see a lot of stuff out there for the horizontal dipoles, but I also see a lot of verticals out there. Am I to assume that's not the only antenna you're going to need if you put up a vertical, or are you not going to miss out a lot of the horizontally polarized signals, you know, with these guys with the big beams?
Good question, Bob. And I presume you're an HFDXer, which means that 90-some-odd% of the time the signal you use is bouncing off the ionosphere. How familiar are you with a phenomenon called Faraday rotation? Back to you, Bob.
I've heard of it. That's about it.
Okay. When you study Faraday rotation, and the guys who have studied it the most, the guys doing moon bounce on, say, 2 meters, When the signal goes through the ionosphere on 2 meters, very rarely is it reflected except during an intense cloud called sporadic E. Most of the time the signal goes roaring right through that ionosphere. Therefore you'd say the ionosphere is essentially transparent and there's no problem. Let's assume now that you understand the three-dimensional geometry between you, the moon, and the guy you want to talk to in, let's say, Japan. The guy in Japan and you can both see the moon at the same time, and you studied the geometry and you figured out for what he calls his local horizontal polarization and what you call your local horizontal polarization. You use those two horizontals as reference, and you figure out what's going on with the moon in its particular position in the sky at that particular time. And you figure out, well, I've got to tilt the polarization of my antenna 45 degrees up to the left in order to match his polarization as far as the geometry is concerned. You do that experiment during moon mount, and you'll find out that almost half the time, he is cross-polarized to your calculation. And you'll say, what in the world is going on here? Well, it turns out that the Earth's ionosphere is a plasma. Plasma is the fourth state of matter, where the electrons and the nucleuses of those molecules have been separated from each other. It's a conducting medium. It's a conducting gas. So that plasma, when mixed with the Earth's magnetic field, has all the raw ingredients to do polarization shift. You may issue a horizontal signal that goes through the ionosphere and comes out of the ionosphere on the first pass vertical. And then you'd say, well, when it hits off the moon and comes back, it's going to reverse going through the ionosphere in the other direction. It turns out that Faraday rotation does not obey the law of reciprocity. It may twist, the signal may twist clockwise 90 degrees on the way out. It may twist another 90 degrees on the way back, in the same direction, so to speak. Strange stuff. It's a function of the angles, the strength of the magnetic field, all those kind of jazz. There's a lot of stuff involved, and you can read a number of references on it. The thing you want to know most, let me drop, is that Faraday rotation is a function of 1 over frequency squared or 1 over frequency cubed. I keep forgetting which. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, like 1296, Faraday rotation is almost gone. It's still going to give you some grief at 432, and it gives you a lot of grief on 6 meters, and more grief as you go down. Now, let's talk about that signal you and I use on, let's say, 20 meters, 14 megacycles, to talk to my buddy in London. Yeah, the signal has to make a couple of hops off the ionosphere and off the ocean in order to get between here and London. That signal that you launch horizontally on Long Island might go through 2 or 3 or 4 twists before it gets to London. And when it goes, and when London issues a signal, it's going through some number of twists in some other crazy direction before it gets back to you. You can easily issue a horizontal signal that arrives vertical in London after 2 or 3 twists. An awful lot of the QSB fading that you hear, you think it's a signal hopping over you and hopping under you. Maybe half the time, it is polarization shift. If you had a horizontal and vertical signal on your property that you could flip back and forth from during your time you're talking to your buddy in London and you're seeing a Faraday rotation, you're seeing a QSB fade, and you flip over to the other polarization, roughly half the time the signal will come back. So once you consider yourself to be using HF frequencies and bouncing off the ionosphere, and you worry about cross-polarization, and you think you've devised, you think you've purchased or built an antenna of the wrong polarization to your talk to your particular class of people, you are conveniently completely forgetting about what that Faraday rotation of that ionosphere is doing to your signal every day of the week. So there's more to it than first meets the eye. I wonder if you're hearing that for the first time, Bob. AC2AZ, K2RIW.
When you speak of the rotation, I understand it optically. Quarter wave plates do the same thing. You know, you go in, rotate it right hand circular, and then when it comes back again through, it'll again do it right hand circular. And it will not, again, like you said, follow reciprocity. That's interesting. So basically you're saying it doesn't matter, or I need both, one of each. I remember when I used to play with CB in my younger years, high school years, they had the Moonrakers, they were the big fancy beams, and they were horizontal and vertical, and often they would switch polarization. So are you saying I can get away with one or the other, whichever is more convenient for me?
Okay. You're now asking me, should you build a horizontal or vertical antenna? Now, that's like asking me, will I be happier if I marry a blonde or a brunette? Or a redhead? In all cases, the total number of variables involved are a lot higher than first meets the eye. A purely vertically polarized half-wave dipole fed at the bottom as a J-pole suspended from a tree that's high enough can give you a hell of a lot more performance for very few dollars by comparison to a $500 quarter-wave ground plane with 32 radials in the backyard. The quarter-wave ground plane that works on multiple bands, that's got all kinds of loading coils and shiny pieces of aluminum, whatever, and costs a lot of money, it looks like a substantial piece of hardware. And your pocketbook and your eyes are telling you, boy, this thing's got to have high performance. Just look at it. You compare that to a simple horizontal dipole that you shoot up into the trees with a bow and arrow or with a slingshot, or a pure vertical dipole, which has got a much higher center of radiation and doesn't require, if it's a half-wave vertical dipole, doesn't require a zillion ground plane radials. In either case, you'll make very little investment in dollars and get a hell of a lot more performance. So should you put up a horizontal dipole and a vertical dipole? Yes. Do you need them both right away? No. But if you've got the resources, there's advantages to each. The wire you string in the air is only seen by you. You can ask every one of the neighbors that have ever visited your house, hey, what's the color of the shingles on my house? They will not be able to answer it. And they don't even know the color of your shingles, which is a massive object as far as square area is concerned. You think you're going to see, they're going to see the wires that you string in the air? Not a chance. So we amateurs, we go around looking for wire, and it shows up in our brain real bright. The average person does not. So fill up the backyard with all kinds of wires up in the air, and unless you live in a very tightly controlled condominium, it should work out very well as far as whether or not you get any flack from the super, so to speak. And when it comes to we amateurs, how many antennas are enough? That's sort of like saying, how much money is enough? Over to you, Bob, K2RIW.
Oh, thank you, Dick. AC2AZ. But first of all, I have to say your first analogy you gave is completely wrong. We all know it's blonde. It's always been blonde. It always will be blonde. But anyway, yeah, I was thinking of probably just doing a multi-band horizontal dipole. I get about 65-foot band, so it sounds like I was thinking of a G5 on the Junior 30. And I think that'll probably fit me just fine. I did make one contact with a little piece of wire hanging on the back of the window here, so that seems to work for a little while. But yeah, I guess maybe I could do a vertical later on. I like the idea of hanging the wires right from the tree there, just hanging it vertical. That sounds a little bit very convenient. Back to you, AZ2AZ.
In the case of a quarter-wave ground plane, where you have to, if you're really an efficiency enthusiast, you have to put down something like 32 radials. You're trying to make your whole backyard act like a perfect conducting sheet of copper, like a perfect mirror, so that the quarter-wave radiator you've got above the ground sees a perfect mirror image of itself in the ground for the other half of the dipole. Well, those 32 radials and all the other doodads that are required for a good quarter-wave ground plane antenna, vertical ground plane, is a hell of a lot more work than simply stringing a half-wave dipole in the air. The best way to make the mirror image of the first quarter-wave radiators in the air is to put out a quarter-wave radio down below it. A half-wave dipole does it. You've got a higher center of radiation. You clear the local terrain a lot better. You light up much less of the soil in your backyard. You waste less energy. It's an extremely unpopular antenna. Look at any of the simple antenna books, and you'll see horizontal dipoles parallel to the ground, fed in the center. You'll see a zillion of them. You won't see one single vertical half-wave dipole on, say, 20, 40, or 80 meters as a recommended construction article. It's just a matter of fixed thinking. It's time we think out of the box, if you know what I mean. Mel, K2KEY, has been using a half-wave vertical dipole made out of green wire, which is strung into the evergreen tree in the front of his house. He's been using it for a number of years. It's one of the highest performance antennas he owns, and even a ham radio operator visiting his property has great trouble seeing that antenna when you tell him which direction to look, and there it is. Let's have a couple of words from Mel as to how happy he is with that antenna. And why haven't more people built it? Because they don't believe you at first, because they don't understand the physics of all this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I've tried I've tried that experiment with a number of people, especially hams, that were standing in front of my house and were talking about the looking at first, of course, my tower with my beams on there. And then we start talking about, you know, antennas for 30 meters and 40 meters and 80 meters. And I'll point out for 80 meters, I have this horizontal loop, 272 feet of, you know, full-wave horizontal loop. And then I'll mention something else about my vertical antenna for the same setup. And I'll say, well, I got a full-size vertical antenna for 80 meters. That's my alternate antenna. I just say I've experimented with switching back and forth a number of times because I found that the horizontal loop for 80 meters excellent for my communications with my friends in, up in Massachusetts and down south, a couple of them, Pennsylvania, Ohio area. But the DX antenna, I find, is my vertical that has approximately around 100 radials that are buried. Now, I've had a number of people standing right there, and they said, where is this antenna, Mel? I'm dying to see this antenna. I'm saying to them, you're standing no more than a few feet from it, and maybe 10 feet or 15 feet from it on the sidewalk if you're standing in front of my house. And they said, I can't imagine where it is. And then when I walk them over and I say, look up the tree. You have to look at just the right angle so you can see the top lip of it. And if you don't look at the right way and everything, Dick, I've fooled hams, I've fooled everybody so far with it. But works, I can say, exceptionally well over.
And that vertical in the tree made out of green wire, what bands have you used that on, Mel?
It's at 80-40. It's 65 feet approximately from the ground, straight up. And it's green wire. It goes up all the way to the whip. I have a whip section that's mounted at the top of the tree there. That's the top section. That's the point where it really, you know, pokes up there above the top of the tree. That's the end. So, that it's on it's PVC pipe actually that I use to secure it to the branch, one of the uppermost branches, Dick, because there was no way for me really, I don't know, I was a little bit tricky about climbing right to the very, very top of the 65, 70 foot point on the tree. So getting about 12 feet below that point, the top, I make up that distance, I used a whip antenna over.
That's a nice arrangement. As you can tell, Bob, there's a zillion ways to make an antenna and to make it compatible with your particular property. And there were a couple of books written on the subject of stealth antenna installations if you've got a super, a wife, or a neighbor that really is kind of persnickety and doesn't want to be able to visually see antennas. Most people, though, are not very reluctant to accept wire. Obvious by the fact that almost all of the streets in our residential communities have a telephone pole every 150 feet, a utility pole, and lots of people die because of hitting those. But we don't even see them. Our eyes, when we drive on the road, we don't see the utility poles. They've always been there, and we ignore them, and all the wires that go in between them. We don't see those either. So if you just extend that a little bit and put a couple of wires in the air in your backyard, and if the neighbor suddenly complains about that, it is a complaint because he is aware and because he senses a change, not because he really is rejecting of that kind of an object to be in that particular residential community. If so, he should be talking to Con Ed and Loco and all the other power companies, New Jersey Power and Light, saying eliminate all that wiring. One of the first things that happens when a person from Europe comes to the United States, it will say, how in the world do you guys tolerate all of that ugliness of all of that wiring. Now, we've insisted that it all be underground. Well, the explanation for that is, let me drop. Part of it's prediction, part of it is reliability, and part of it is cost. You can insist on underground wiring in your particular community if the community is being built brand new. But that wiring will be two or three times more expensive and lower in reliability. That's the hard one to accept. So it costs more and doesn't work as well, but other than that, it's pretty. And so should we all have underground wiring? There's pros and cons to that one. But if the community is already established and you tell all the residents how much their taxes are going to go up in order to pay for the price of the installation of underground wiring now, I think 95% of that community will say, no way, particularly not during the hard times we're going through right now. So, I know I'm off subject a little bit, but any further comments from you, Bob? Go right ahead. AC2AZ, K2RAW. Let us know, by the way, as you do put up this super new rock crusher antenna of yours, what you decided to put up and how well it works. And you're going to put up antennas that are compatible with blondes, and I understand that. You got it, Bob.
Thanks, Dick. I was wondering, has anybody taken a G5RV and made it vertical and stretched out the ladder line horizontally out the required distance and put something like that together? I think the other type of halfway dipole center fed, you can use a coaxial one. I remember making a small antenna for VHF by taking the shield of coax and stretching it out and wrapping it back over the coax, making both of them, I think it was a quarter wavelength long for total half wavelength. But anyway, has anybody ever done any center fed verticals?
Yes, a few people have, very few. And by the way, that stripping back the braid and folding it back is sometimes it's called a bazooka antenna, and that can work very well. But feeding, there's nothing magic about feeding the antenna from the bottom. We're very used to the idea of feeding a dipole in the center where the impedance is around 72 ohms. I will admit there is one slight disadvantage of feeding it from the bottom, and that is the end impedance. And by the way, let me backtrack on this one. There's nothing magic about feeding a dipole in the center. You can feed it in the center, 10% off center, quarter off center, half off center, three quarters of the way off center, or you can feed it at the end. If you're smart enough electronically, the choice is yours. The performance of all of those places of feeding are the same if you have the right balancing action going on, so you're not launching a current onto the outside shield of the coax cable. Feeding it at the bottom is a perfectly reliable idea, and you don't need more than one ground plane radio most of the time, and maybe not even that, because you're feeding 1,000 or 1,500 ohm impedance. It's a little bit difficult to think about the differences of feeding 1,000 ohm impedance versus feeding a 50 ohm impedance or a 70 ohm impedance in the center. A very simple impedance step-up network is required to do that. The base of every 5/8 wave mag mount you have ever used possesses that 1,000 ohm step-up impedance device. Can you make a version of that on 80 meters? Absolutely. But a J-pole does that for you automatically. So a J-pole is a kind of a half-wave vertical antenna set at the bottom. So there's nothing magic about feeding it in the center. Go through all the mechanical rigmarole of bringing the transmission line to the center if you want to. You don't have to. Now, would it still be called a G5RV, which normally has the twin lead for a certain section of feeding it, which is part of the impedance matching device, and with low enough loss feed line and a wide enough dynamic range antenna tuner in the shack, a good piece of coax feeding it from the bottom will work like a charm. And if you want to go the next step, maybe use open wire line to feed it at the bottom. The open wire line might have 600 ohm impedance, and you're feeding 1,000. It has a very low VSWR just to begin with. And you can't buy a lower loss feed line that is homebrew
repeater. Time out.
600 ohm open wire line is the lowest loss feed line you will ever use, and you can homebrew it if you want to. Out of a 14-gauge household wire, for instance, for the two conductors, and build yourself a series of insulators of some kind that goes in between the two, wood, plastic, porcelain, whatever. And there's nothing magic about 600 ohms. make it whatever spacing you like, whatever impedance you like. Your antenna tuner, with the right way you're feeding it, will accommodate all that. Almost no one has written any articles about feeding the bottom of a halfway vertical antenna. And what little evidence we see, it's an extremely high-performance, very simple, inexpensive antenna. It's about time that we start thinking out of the box and give it more emphasis, in my opinion. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call, let us right now. KQLIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY. Just going to make one more comment about HF antennas over there.
Go right ahead, Bill.
Yeah, you know, the debate goes on and on whether to go with a vertical or go with a horizontal, and you sort of covered that quite a bit the Faraday rotation situation. But it seems that everybody in agreement, the real DXers, all in agreement, think that their best way that they have achieved their success as being these big DX stations is with antennas that are extremely elevated, in other words, going up at least 100 feet or more. They, for some reason, feel that in order to get on any of the HF bands that low takeoff, so-called low takeoff angle, that that is how they succeed in working all the exotic stations, is because they said they reduce, of course, the number of hops from one place A to place B, especially in DXing. So you want to say a few words about height, Dick, over?
Yeah, and this is a slightly controversial area. When it comes to VHF and UHF antennas, every foot of altitude buys you some benefit with rare exceptions. There's three things to make a VHF, UHF antenna work well. Altitude,